That is super loud.
And kind of angry. Are you angry, mate?
Trump, tariffs, impending economic doom, February weather. Yeah, I'm angry. And when I'm really angry, I express my emotions through music.
Angry music?
Yeah, that's right, man. And one more thing, Adam. You remember the last time I played a new musical intro for the pod and somehow you forgot to record it?
Yeah, sorry about that.
Yeah, I'm telling you both right now, you better lay down this track. I'm in no mood for screw-ups.
Okay, Dan. No problems.
Okay, boys. It's time to rock. We're on a podcast to hell. Podcast to hell. Podcast to hell.
The Winnipeg Free Press proudly presents, in partnership with CJNU 93.7 FM, Negan and the Lone Ranger. Here are your hosts, Negan Sinclair and Dan the Lone Ranger Lett.
Bonjour, hello, greetings, bonjour everybody. Welcome to Season 4, Episode 1 of the Lone Ranger and Negan podcast. How did I suddenly get top billing?
It used to be Negan and the Lone Ranger.
I know. This is the kind of changes we're instituting this season.
Woohoo! Things You've, are going to start happening for me now.
Your pay is officially doubled.
Work is certainly officially doubled, especially this week. It's very good to be back. I don't think there was any question we were going to come back. But, 2024, how can I put this? 2024 sucks. It sucked.
It was pretty awful.
It was pretty awful. For those of you probably know some of this, but Negan and I both lost a father last year.
That's all you can really say about that.
Yeah. Yeah. Like there were other good things. I mean, it wasn't like there was, only bad things, but that certainly framed a lot of the year. It is good to be back. I got to tell you that I have actually been getting correspondence from people asking when we would be back.
I did get a lot of people who asked, hey, when are you going to do the podcast again? And I said, when the world is on fire. That's what I said. So here we are.
Well, what a premonition. I'm blessed by the fact that my daughter has a fairly large group of friends who are all fans of the podcast. So, hey, Joe,
two
hey, Cody,
you.
Hey, Carl, shout out to the fan club.
It's like, romper room for our fans because we know all of them personally.
Hey, listen, anybody who's, got a longer life expectancy and listens to the podcast, I would like to encourage other people of my daughter's age to make us a regular stop on your podcast, listening journey. It's funny though, that we didn't know exactly when we were going to pull it together. So what we did, of course, is we picked one of the most dynamic and constantly evolving news weeks in the country's history, which lots of stuff to talk about. But
this week has already been on the podcast quite a week. I will give a little disclosure to everybody. This is not our first recording, I'll say, because we have the news cycle has been so fast and furious, and we recorded some pieces And then immediately, almost hours afterwards, they were outdated. And so here we are. We're going to try to slap this together as quickly as we can. And we've got a great feature interview of somebody who you really want to hear from, especially this time period that we're in right now. And so we're going to get this done as quickly as we can. Let's talk about exactly where we are right now. And people will be able to figure out exactly when we have recorded this, because it'll change 20 minutes from now.
Yes, I was going to say, I'm going to be watching the New York Times homepage throughout the entire interview, and we're going to pivot really fast if we need to. So by now, everybody knows that we were on the verge of a trade war with the United States. They were going to impose tariffs on our imports to the United States. We were going to impose tariffs on U.S. imports to Canada. It was going to be a knock them down, drag them out, boost inflation, lower wages, and, lay people off kind of, continental trade screw up.
It was unpredictable in every way. And typical kind of since Donald Trump has entered, and speaking of 2024, he came in, is now, he rules everything in the United States, every element of government, the Senate, the House, the judiciary, and so he can run roughshod. And so by threatening these tariffs and keeping proposing he's going to do it, which he did during the election campaign, Canada basically got ready for an unprecedented time. And we saw Justin Trudeau give what was, let's hope, the closest we'll ever see to a wartime speech of, hey, let's rally the troops. Everybody focus on your neighbor. Everybody has to pitch in and buy Canadian, and we'll fight these tariffs. And he even evoked John F. Kennedy during his speech, which was...
Yeah. This is absolutely a wet dream for a lame duck prime minister, because the whole point is like, so he resigns, then he prorogues parliament. And then, like, for 2 weeks, he gets his ass kicked all over the place, particularly by Pierre Poilievre, the conservative leader. And he's disparaged, disgraced, kicked out of the party by his own people. Liberals are rushing to pick a new leader. And then all of a sudden, he's like, back in front of the lectern. He's, promising to return tariff fire with tariff fire. And, I don't know that it's going to change Trudeau's rather woeful legacy at this point. But it is like, if you're a lame duck prime minister, it certainly gives you something to do, rather than hiding in your living room with the shades drawn. Now he's got something to do. So
one of my columns I wrote was kind of who's auditioning for Captain Canada. And I think everybody universally thinks Doug Ford, with a kind of vice captain of Premier Wobkamu in Manitoba. But seeing Justin Trudeau really in, I think, almost like a gift. If you can think of a glass half full and think about it. I mean, yeah. The guy dedicates his years to the country, and he gets this last moment to really, fight off a rather threatening force of Donald Trump, and that was Monday.
That was our mistake, our bad, for trying to do a podcast on a Monday, the beginning of the 5-day news cycle. What a bunch of morons.
When we were recording the podcast, and dear listener, I hope that you can probably figure out what time we were doing it, while we were recording, there was an announcement that Trump, of course, he was going to also impose tariffs on Mexico. And then, boom, he makes an agreement on Monday morning. We see it right as we're recording. Oh, now there's no tariffs on Mexico for a month. And so we sort of openly mused, well, possibly this opens the doorway for Canada. And then just a few hours later, boom, Justin Trudeau tweets out, I've spoken with President Trump. We've agreed on a border czar, whatever that is. And then we are going to somehow, we're now going to be 30 days free of tariffs as well, which doesn't really mean anything. All it means is that we're in a bit of a delay period while Trump decides to go focus on the Middle East.
Yeah, well, that's right. Of buying or just assuming control of Gaza, with plans to turn it into the Riviera of the Middle East. And I'm sure this has nothing to do with the fact that he's a hotel, golf course, and resort,
Oh, I think it.
like, yeah. But but more importantly, the pause on tariffs. And let's do a quick tutorial on tariffs. So, tariffs are charges that are put on imports or exports. They are usually used to punish another trading partner for either unfair trade practices, or it can be for other things. Tariffs and trade embargoes are used to punish countries that are doing particularly heinous things. And in general, it's a last resort tool that really benefits no one, depending on the outcome, of course. But inflation goes up, people lose their jobs, currencies are thrown into turmoil. Like it's coming out of this, a period of incredibly high inflation and the economic disruption of the pandemic. Like, if you had to pick one thing that you shouldn't do, then a spiteful, poorly justified trade war would certainly be on the top of the list. But somebody must have said that's the worst possible idea, President Trump, and he said, "Yeah, let's go, baby, yeah."
There is a school of thought, though, and I think it's the school of thought that probably influences Trump, that tariffs are a good thing. And Trump is certainly not the first administration to propose these. Not that we saw this in a, maybe in an administration, but in the 1980s, very protectionist movements in the United States, led by, Reagan, but then also Pat Buchanan. And I think that there was an idea that when you lose manufacturing, that when you lose basically your ability to service your own causes, your own products, your own, you then put on tariffs on those goods that you want to inspire manufacturing within your own country. And I think that is in my glass half lame-brained way of saying, I think Donald Trump was trying to produce manufacturing, and particularly in the automotive sector, because this keeps coming up over and over again, and he wants to have build cars in Michigan and North Carolina and so on. What if anyone knows the automotive sector in Ontario, the way that it operates out in Windsor, Southern Ontario, is car parts travel across the border sometimes multiple times a day. And what pieces of that car, which eventually get assembled in plants on either side, that the movements, if there was a tariff, every time they cross, they would be costing another tax, which would obliterate and bankrupt every single car manufacturer. And so I guess the idea is that somehow those car manufacturers would then choose a country and, of course, be incentivized for some reason or another. And maybe this is a drive to kill the auto industry and build Elon Musk's empire even further. Who knows?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that's a big part of the curiosity or the mystery of all this is really because, part and parcel, and you mentioned the automotive industry, is this weird attempt by the Trump administration to discourage the manufacture and development of electric vehicles and batteries. And you don't have to search far on the interweb to get news about how unpopular this is with automotive manufacturers. I mean, Ford, for example, is in the process of investing billions of dollars of its own money. They're not even looking for government handouts to build factories that build EVs and batteries. And those investments you can't put those investments back in the bottle. There's no way for government to compensate. So I mean, I think I've come to a slightly different opinion about the tariffs. Either it was such a horribly constructed idea that You know, it was going to take time for Trump and his acolytes to figure out that it was a horribly constructed idea, or else, you know, quite frankly, he's f-ing with us. You know,
Well, I think
because yeah, because like the so the theory and our you know our special surprise guest, the he who we have not mentioned yet, but which I'm going to say we're going to be talking with former Manitoba Premier and former Canadian Ambassador to the United States, Gary Doer, who like he was on the front line of trade wars with the Barack Obama administration, because it really this kind of tariff f***ery is really not limited to just Republicans, although the way Trump is going about it is uniquely Trump. You know, tariffs are unpopular and impractical because they raise the cost of things for people in the country imposing the tariffs. So cars become more expensive, computers become more expensive. I read a story about a company in the United States that builds robots to be used in all forms of manufacturing. Well, half the parts of those robots come from China, which is actually you know, subject to a 10% tariff right now. It means higher prices and lost jobs. The great equalizer for the Trump administration is how this unfolds at the congressional district level. So, Republican or Democrat, when people start losing their jobs, when things get more expensive, when the pain of tariffs starts to be felt by Americans, that's when people on the front lines of the U.S. The American political system, that's when they start to you know, get nervous. And so I don't know that he has a solution for that.
That may be, you may have identified exactly why he rolled back from it. I mean, he's claiming it a victory because he got us to put money into the border and have a border czar. By the way, all of that was negotiated with Joe Biden. That was all coming anyways. And so
Ooh, ooh, and I want to do another checklist of all the things that we gave in. Like, 'cause you know, the media spokesperson for the president said we bent the knee.
yeah, that's
Okay.
exactly.
Yeah. So, okay, so this is how we bent the knee. So basically, you know, we're not a big player in fentanyl. We don't produce or traffic a lot of fentanyl. We are not a major source of fentanyl flowing into the United States. But despite that, like we're going to spend billions of dollars on increased border security. Here's the big joke. Here's the thing. You know, that's not just designed to stop things from going into the United States. It's also helpful a little bit in stopping bad things from coming from the United States into Canada. So I can't really see, like, Trump may take some comfort in it, but honestly, I don't know, maybe we needed, you know, to be more secure in the border. But right now, Trump 1.0 was the trigger for mass illegal migrant travel into Canada, sometimes with tragic results. It's going to be harder for those people to get to a place like Canada, for better or for worse. I don't know that that's really a necessarily a good thing, but yeah. But you know, we get the benefit of a more secure border.
Okay, so I'm at the Winnipeg Jets game just soon after, in the context of all of this tariff, then walk back. And then I think what I was going to say was, I think the trigger point was there was a bunch of polls that came out on Tuesday indicating that tariffs were extremely unpopular amongst US citizens to the tune of about 2 to 1. So, like, two-thirds of Americans were not supportive of Donald Trump imposing tariffs on trade partners, particularly Canada, but then other countries as well. And so I think that may have helped speed up some of this walk back. But I'm at the Winnipeg Jets game. I don't know if this is the first time I've ever heard it, but I certainly saw it at the Toronto Raptors game. I saw it at the Ottawa Senators game. Mass booing of the US national anthem. And credit to our wonderful colleague, a good friend of my family, Stacey Natras, who sang all the way through it, still did an amazing job as she always does. Local singer, has been doing the Jets anthems for years. But rampant booing. I heard people screaming out, "The United States, you suck." And so there's an interesting thing that may be coming out of this. In this move to ally the premiers, get the prime minister together, everybody saying, buy local, focus local, let's rebuild local industry and manufacturing. There is a kind of double down on Canadians and Canadians. And I also think I was on syndication this week for another network, and that means multiple interviews talking the same question. And one thing that was asked is, what's the impact on Indigenous peoples? And of course, we know that whenever prices raise, whenever layoffs happen, whenever scarcity becomes the norm, Indigenous peoples are the most impacted because we have the least access. We also often are in poverty, et cetera, et cetera. And so I think a really interesting thing may come for this, and maybe we will thank Donald Trump. This is my glass half full of way of thinking about it, is very few times have you seen multiple sectors who previously have been spending a lot of time arguing, especially over the past few years, over rights and economic projects and jurisdiction. And then boom, everybody seems to be just doubling down on each other. And nothing like a good old orange beast enemy to focus all of your energy upon.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of repercussions coming from this that I if they are to come to fruition, these things, they could become a massive political issue for Donald Trump. So, you know, for example, just about like in anticipation of Trump 2.0, there are efforts underway right now for, big trading blocks to establish new deals that bypass the United States. Now, the United States is the biggest, economy in the world. In theory, nobody wants to, stop doing business with Americans. However, if it becomes impractical, people find different ways of doing business. So the European Union has been most active in doing this. Last December, signed a landmark agreement with five South American countries, Brazil, Argentina, Uruguay, Paraguay, and Bolivia, and it is becomes the world's biggest free trade zone, completely leapfrogging the United States. 700 million people and 20% of the world's gross domestic product, which speaks to the issue that I think Canadians are thinking about now. If I could buy it from another source other than an American company or an American business, why wouldn't I do that? If I can sell it to somebody other than an American, why wouldn't I do that? And the fact is, it can be done. And it is being done. And,
table. Yeah, like that's the amazing thing is I think when you have a regular status quo trading agreement, while bumpy and turbulent, whether it be Obama or whether it be George Bush or even in recent years, Joe Biden, there's always been bumps along the path between the United States and Canada. But when you have an en masse wholesale change that evokes people doing unprecedented things, imagining the possibilities of doing crazy things like our best trade partner becomes the EU, or maybe the best trade partner becomes we already trade really quite aggressively with elements of Asia, and so like maybe that becomes the pipelines, maybe that becomes the trade networks, or maybe that becomes the free trade agreements that we then forge and create. And like the idea that people are thinking in an unprecedented or acting in unprecedented ways means unprecedented solutions.
No, I agree. And I have to sort of say in my mind, I do like to keep be mindful of the fact that I don't really take a lot of joy in punishing U.S. businesses and U.S. workers. We're not at war with U.S. wineries. When we pull U.S. wine off our shelves, we're at war with the president of the United States. We're not, you know, we should take no joy in the fact that we're going to hurt a lot of people, a lot of people that are innocently caught in the you know, in the rantings of a somewhat, I think, unbalanced leader. But, you know, I think on the other hand, too, it's amazing how quickly Canadians have come to the idea of, yeah, come on, yeah, let's, yeah, you know, you want to, you know, in hockey parlance, right? You want to shed? Let's shed. Let's go, baby. You know, you want to dance? And I just, it was so amazing last weekend to watch people go from being probably, what's a tariff, to, oh my God, you know, like, I'm never going to drink California wine again. You know, some of this stuff, once people switch and they make changes, it's going to be, you know, they're going to find they don't need to go back. So, you know.
So that brings us to, well, I mean, I was trying to build a bridge there, Lone Ranger. So I was trying to build like a positive bridge to our wonderful guest. But you took it to the woodshed.
No, exactly. Parenthetically, let's just say we are so glad there isn't a 25% tariff on American cultural icons and institutions, because otherwise we would have suddenly been, we would have been subject to a tariff at Negan and the Lone Ranger. Right. Or the Lone Ranger in Negan, as you prefer to call it right now.
For this week, everything's upside down, so I turned everything.
So, yes, we are like really oddly fortunate that if you really want to understand the mechanics of what's going on right now, the politics of it, the number one guy in Canada who knows about all this stuff happens to be a former premier in Manitoba, Gary Dewar, and a friend of this podcast, our very first guest. So let's talk to Gary, and hopefully he'll be able to tell us that we're going to be okay. Gary, I've been looking forward to this conversation. There's so much has happened in the world. Are we going to be okay?
Of course we are. Well, we're going to go through some rapids.
Well, we're back in the canoe in the rapids, are we?
Yeah, I think that's actually where we are.
So for those of you, again, scoring at home, when Gary was the first minister of Manitoba, he frequently would refer to navigating the rapids in a canoe and searching for the calm, open water. Yes,
that's exactly right.
So maybe the better question to ask you is, what is happening right now? Like, it's honestly, like, I get up every morning, look at my computer, I go to the New York Times and the Washington Post, and I have to kind of read through my, like, I have to look through my fingers. I'm afraid to actually kind of see. Have you ever seen anything this like this, even Trump 1.0?
Well, I think he's emboldened with his victory. I think he regretted not doing things in his first term. He certainly regretted losing the election to Biden. I think we've had conversation. I think the last conversation we had was Biden's first midterm elections with the Senate in play in a number of places, including, I think I got New Mexico wrong, but I got all the rest of them right in terms of, you know, Georgia and Pennsylvania and others. But I was at the Woodrow Wilson. I co-chair the Woodrow Wilson Institute with one of my American friends who's ambassador, and before it was David Jacobson, and now it's Bruce Hayman. And when I was there in November, I certainly picked up that Trump has done a lot more work with his transition team on using the authority of president. If he's, you know, when he just got elected president, he's had a team of people working on the authorities that a president had going back to the 1930s to designate through presidential orders areas of decision making that would exceed the normal and former requirement to go to either the Senate or Congress. Even the last USMCA had to be ratified in Congress, and it was ratified partly by, you know, a compromise in a number of different ways.
Right.
But he is now, I remember saying on another broadcast that I thought he would be, completely unilateral in his decision-making. Mm-hmm. He also doesn't have a very good relationship with, dare I say it, Justin Trudeau, the Prime Minister of Canada. And this goes back right back to Charlevoix. And people should remember what happened in Charlevoig.
The G7, yeah.
Yeah, so Trudeau was hosting it. It was issues of tariffs then. I mostly saw it with lumber. And I remember, you know, then Trump was on his way to meet the North Korean dictator. So he left the meeting early, but he had his press conference with the media right off the top before the prime minister and the other leaders. And he said at that time, you know, maybe we should, when he was asked about tariffs, maybe we should just get rid of all the tariffs between Canada and the United States. And I was sitting with Jenny and I said, you know, Trudeau should just go up there with a pen and ask, where do I sign, when he left the podium?
Yeah.
And I said, you know, that's what you would do. And I said, you know, that's what Mulroney would have done, would do. That's what Chrétien would do. That's what Harper would do. And what did Trudeau do? He goes up there. He said, he's obviously got a prepared statement. He doesn't have any kind of agility to react to this gift. And he goes up there and said, well, it's almost like a captured air pilot, you know, we not be pushed around by this guy Trump. Now, all the media loved it, you know, Trudeau had great coverage. Trump's people, Navarro, took a shot at Trudeau, special place in hell, I think they said.
Yeah.
But the bottom line was, you know, when you, at that point, I don't think they ever had a very positive relationship.
Yeah.
Now, Trudeau does not have a very good relationship in Washington with other people either. I was on a panel with the Western elected representatives in the U.S. A couple of years ago, and in the summer with David Jacobson, the former Democratic ambassador. And the big issue was that Trudeau had signed on to the 2% of GDP for our NATO commitment. And then his staff leaked to the Wall Street Journal.
Right.
They had no intent on keeping that commitment. And there was about 4,000 delegates, about 500 from Western Canada, about 3,500 from the U.S., Democrat, Republicans, that couldn't believe it. And, you know, I didn't defend it because, the old saying is that whether you're a labor leader or a journalist or an editor, your word is your bond. And his word was on the piece of paper. And so when we had those senators sign that letter, there was a lot of ones that I work with. They're very, very positive about Canada and its importance in the North American neighborhood. So we've got a horrible situation, Dan, with the combination of his past relationship, his broken word on that very important commitment, and the fact that he's got no authority right now, both in Canada and, of course, in the North American neighborhood. It's a horrible situation. It's just really regrettable that we didn't have an earlier election. It's because nobody's mandate now in Ottawa.
Yeah. I'm just wondering, in terms of what Trump is doing, and I want to do one little aside because I think that among people who know you and your knowledge of U.S. politics, you are pretty darn good at picking races. Did you have an inkling before the election that the Democrats were in trouble?
Yeah, I think it started with the situation with Joe Biden. First of all, I thought in the election before that, Biden was the only person on the Democratic side that could beat Trump and then keep the Senate. So they did keep the Senate in the midterms. And at that point, I thought, and I talked to some of my Democratic friends, I thought Biden can go out, you know, in a very positive way. He defeated Donald Trump and he had kept the Senate, which, and I thought at that point he was, you know, obviously older at that point. I thought, you know, he could potentially look at having a transition. And I remember talking to two of my Democratic ambassador friends, and I suggested he do that. And they said it's not that easy in the Democratic Party because he had chosen Kamala Harris, and they thought that it would be very difficult to get her nominated in a primary. And secondly, that she's a California liberal, and it's very hard to win the swing states. So regrettably, it came down to that one debate on CNN where he just looked awful. Biden, as I say, he'd already beaten Trump, and the hard hats like him in places like Pennsylvania. And unfortunately, they had, I thought, they had a situation where Trump was going to, you know, with running on two things: immigration, which the Democrats never solved, even though it was partly the Republican Trump's, partly his fault because he told them not to settle the go with the Langford agreement, and so immigration and inflation. Now in Canada, we only have inflation. And immigration has become a separate issue, which is in some places being blamed for the cost of housing, which I think is unfortunate in this country.
It's ridiculous.
But we didn't have this massive, and some of the Republican governors were shipping people to New York, to Chicago, to Ohio, you know, to some of the swing states, and it was brutal for Democrats. Democrats with against Trump. So I wasn't surprised it happened. Did I want it to happen? Yep. No.
It's kind of a, like, we haven't really seen a lot of comprehensive polling about how the US people are greeting the first, you know, the first 30 days of Trump, which is, it's just been extraordinary, the pace of the executive orders and the severity of some of them. I know that he did talk about some of these things during the election, but he didn't talk about all of them. Do you get the sense that for the people who supported Donald Trump, that this is the government that they, this is actually the government they wanted? Are people getting what they wanted?
Well, some people are. His base is definitely getting what they wanted. The swing voters definitely think they're getting what they wanted on immigration. And I think that, you know, those presidential orders came out pretty fast on immigration. I think some of his people that voted for him are law and order people. They would not be happy with, you know, when you look at his first 3 or 4 days, the pardon for the people that invaded the Capitol on January 6th.
Right.
Been a lot of coverage of, you know, all the media were staked out covering the situation with people being released from jail, but also a lot of the media covered the police officers that were hurt there or whose colleagues were hurt there. So I thought that really undermined things. I think he had a bad week with the unilateral decision on spending, which affected a lot of his supporters, and they flip-flopped on that issue, rightly, in terms of what's going on. But they are definitely, their transition team, you know, who they're going to nominate for cabinet, they are so far ahead of where they were in 17, way far ahead, further ahead.
Yeah. There was a series of things that, I mean, there are some things where you can sort of see the strategy, And then there's other things that seem to be so poorly conceived. Ending birthright citizenship, which kind of came out of nowhere. You know, early poll results show that, like, people are not only don't support it, but, you know, are actually alarmed by the idea of that. You know, his, you know, what appeared to be some sort of an edict to the oil industry to begin, like, massive new drilling. You know, the oil companies don't want to drill right now. You know, they're in that sweet spot, you know, where supply is at a state where they can get a, you know, a price that's solid, but it's not too high, that drives down usage. And, you know, I just wonder, like, if is this, like, can he sustain support through 4 years and set things up for someone else to come in and take the torch from him?
Well, that'll be interesting. It'll be interesting to watch the rise or fall of two of his major people, obviously the Vice President Vance, and the other one, Rubio, who, of course, the Secretary of State usually gets a lot more media and deals a lot more meaty issues than the Vice President, who, you know, is not... They break a tie vote. That's what they do. And the Secretary of State is representing the American people all over the world. So the question really becomes, and the leverage for a country like Canada dealing with a trade war with the United States is, what impact will it have on the midterms for maintaining the Senate? Not only did Trump, his base turnout, but they also have a situation where they have a two-seat, three-seat majority, depending on what day it is in the Congress, and they also have a majority in the Senate. And that is, you know, so it's really important for people that are not in favor of what Trump's done, and he's got a lot of runway before the midterms, but one of the last tests to his political legacy is going to be the midterms. Mm-hmm. And that they come pretty quickly, you know. The Americans are always in an election cycle, and those midterms will be really important, as they were for Biden when we chatted last time.
U.S. president, like a sitting U.S. president, more often than not loses ground in midterms, though, do they not?
Well, normally the incumbent is on the defensive, and, you know, time for a change is powerful, whether it's in Canada right now or it was in Manitoba, you know, 18 months ago, in the U.S. If people, it's the easiest ballot question for an opposition. Time for a change, and it's easy. People are disappointed. For example, the Trump dilemma here on the trade wars, with including Canada. This is why I'm sure they're still mulling over oil. They don't want Trump. What does Trump want out of this? He actually believes that the worst thing that can happen coming into the next midterms is the tax reductions he made when he was president. They expire at the end of 2025, and he does not want the beginning of 2026, which is the beginning of the swing election year, to have an increase in taxes. He does not want that. His legacy, and he does not want it to be part of the disappointment going into the midterms. And so he thinks he can pay for those taxes partly from tariffs from other countries. So that's what's partly going on right now. Again, this was part of his transition. How do I pay for my taxes? And they came up with the idea, you have the authority to do these tariffs and pay for it from other countries' money.
But it's a pretty one-dimensional economic argument, though, because it completely ignores the fact that if he actually does what he says he's going to do, everybody expects that the U.S. economy will shrink to a certain extent. Like, there will be pain felt by businesses and individuals in the United States. So he may be collecting that additional money through tariffs, but he's going to be losing money in tax revenue collected.
I do believe he's made the wrong calculation, his team, because if particularly, and this is why he's probably mulling over, as we speak right now, mulling over oil. Because if the price of gas goes up 75 cents to a dollar a gallon because of these tariffs with Canadian oil and some Mexican oil isn't as large as the Canadian oil, then he will have high inflation. And inflation, I think, is more negative than it's not offset by a tax reduction or maintaining a current tax situation. So I agree with you. It's the economic policies that affect people and affect the midterm. Inflation is more salient than tax cuts.
Now, one of the things I know you've brought up in some other interviews has been the role that the governors could play in how the trade war unfolds. And, you know, your time in Washington as Canada's ambassador, you know, you developed some pretty important and deep relationships with governors, you know, as various Buy American and other sort of nationalist economic policies floated through the debate in the United States. So, like, what's your sense of the status or the state of opinion among governors, and how persuasive could, because my understanding is that most of the states where, you know, they're getting a good deal from Canadian goods coming across the border, they're worried about what it's going to do to their own economies. Can they be persuasive?
Yeah, I think they can, because they have a big megaphone with their own public. And also they run the economy. The Senate doesn't run a state economy. They send two senators to Washington who are usually worried about, particularly with Trump being primaried by, you know, they don't stay on the good side of him and vote with him. But the governors don't have that pressure. They usually have a lot more say in their economy. And the one thing the premier, I was invited to by Premier Ford to attend the premier's meeting in early December with Frank McKenna. And one of the things I recommended they do, and I've talked to Premier Kanua about this, is show up at the governor's meeting, which is usually mid to late February, because governors have the same role as premiers, and they also have something in common, because they both, you know, there's respect for people that have put their names on the ballot and have, you know, run for in campaigns and been elected. There's sort of kind of a respect that way, which I found was still there in Washington when I was there as a former premier. And although I had met a lot of governors before then, we, you know, I think you remember we brought Janet DePalatano up here. She was Secretary of Homeland Security later on. I think it's one of the things that Prime Minister Harper knew when he asked me to take the job. Right. The governor-premier relationship is very important, and particularly in the border. And those, again, the border states will still be one of the main areas of some really tight Senate races in a couple of years.
Right. Yeah. And the governor's meetings, you're talking about like the National Governors Association, like their big summit meeting in Washington.
Yeah, that's right. And not only do they have meetings, they invite other people to speak to their meetings. Hopefully the premiers through the chair of the premiers, of course, in this time around is the Premier of Ontario, but hopefully they can get into the room and meet with the governors. They can't do it one-on-one. They could do it as a group. And the governors then usually meet with the president the next day or a day and a half. They usually have dinner and have a session directly with the president.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's hard to imagine a president following through with even though it was part of his talk track through the entire election, and certainly, you know, in the period after the election and before the inauguration, it was really intense, you know, tariffs here, tariffs there. But it's, the economics is weak. Public support is weak. Sector, like industry, you know, and sector support is weak. I mean, like, am I missing somebody? Is there somebody other than Donald Trump and some of the people around him who thinks that tariffs are a good idea?
Oh, there's people around him that think they are. But I don't, there's also people around him that aren't saying it to him, but they know that this could lead to inflation, which would undermine his win and undermine his popularity. So we're in a situation now, and this is why he's mulling over. I guess he's really now getting worried about banning oil. Not really worried. We'll see what he does on, in the next couple of days. But if he bans oil, there's no question that's going to be really harmful. What should we do? You know, I think we should, you know, I was involved in switching 45 congressional votes in California from against us to for us on country of origin labeling by threatening to ban California wine to Canada with tariffs, and it worked. We switched, you go from 45 no to 45 yes. That's a 90 vote switch in the Congress. But, you know, the bottom line is it's going to be, I think we've got to really stake out something that's futuristic beyond oil. And I would recommend strongly critical minerals. When we were down in Washington, we had a representative from the Vail Mines in front of the Manitoba delegation. Her name was Kennedy, a geologist. And she had a great presentation to the U.S. Chamber of Commerce with Premier Canoe and the business delegation we had. And she said, we are the Costco of critical minerals. We have 29 of 31 that you need. And I think that that is kind of a great way to put it to an American audience.
Yeah.
And I said to Wob, I don't know which one of us is going to steal this line first. But, I think we both have quite quickly.
But, well, let's hope he uses it before our podcast comes out, or else, you know, it'll be, history will show it was yours, Gary. So.
Oh, no. It's Kennedy's.
Oh, okay.
She gets credit. And because I wouldn't know whether it was 2 out of 31 or 29 out of 31. But the bottom, you know, I think we should offer, you know, Trump always needs a win. We're going to have real problems, particularly in Ontario and Quebec on dairy. He's going to go after that even more than just these tariffs. He promised to do it in Wisconsin. He promised actually in New York, who's got a fairly vigorous lobby too on this issue. But I think we should say we will have an agreement with you to provide critical minerals to the United States as a trading partner. And part of that has got to be get off this 4 or 5 years to approve a mine. I mean, when you look at the pipeline being refused in Northern Gateway, that's weakened our leverage. You look at you and I have chatted about pipelines versus oil on rail. You know, Energy East would take a lot of oil off rail and going through cities.
Just to be clear, Gary, you're talking about, if necessary, looking at export tariffs from Canada, Canadian export tariffs on the critical minerals that are running through the Costco checkout.
Well, I would, you know, not necessarily tariffs. I would just say we're not selling them to you.
Oh.
You know,
okay, that would get his attention.
There's an option of tariffs, but there's also an option. The Americans need this, and they're going to have tariffs on China and other places starting this weekend. So, you know, the American business community and a lot of the people Trump's listening to need these things, and a huge fight to get all these, the investments going on in AI in the United States. Three Mile Island has been taken over, I think, by Microsoft. That whole landmass is massive size to deal with the storage and AI that these companies are developing. billions of dollars going into it. Mm. And but they need energy and they need critical minerals. And I think that's one of our advantages. We have them.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's, I mean, but at some point too, like, do you envision a scenario where somehow Trump can get a win, like some sort of a moral victory out of all of this and, you know, pull back on hard tariff, you know,
well, he could get a victory.
Punitive tariffs.
He could get a victory on us keeping our word on NATO.
Right.
He could get a victory on unilateral action. It's kind of interesting because on dairy, Canadian consumers pay more for milk than I know. When I was in Washington, I paid half as much as what I paid in Winnipeg.
Yep.
But it's such a political issue. You've got the Ontario election right now. You've got a couple of elections that are pretty serious in Quebec. You've got the Bloc winning, probably going to be opposition after this election's over in Quebec. Blanchette is really popular and funny and articulate, and this is problematic for Canada. But I do think that he can get a win on dairy, and he which actually is a win for Canadian consumers, ironically. Yeah. He always needs a bumper sticker. He needs a bumper sticker.
Yeah.
Or two.
Yeah. Well, yeah, like it's some sort of trade agreement that, I don't know, can be positioned as a win for U.S. businesses or consumers. I mean, like, of course, none of it makes any sense in terms of economics. But no. You know, like if you're dealing with something that really, doesn't make any sense, I suppose you shouldn't worry about whether your response is completely sensible. I don't know if that makes any sense.
It's interesting. I remember about 8 months, maybe 7 months before Trump declared he was going to run the first time, I talked to a person I know who is a pretty prominent business person, developer in New York. And we were having lunch and I said, you know, I think this guy Trump's going to run for president. I said, what kind of a developer is he? And he said, you sit back to me, he's not a developer. I'm a developer. He's a marketer.
Yeah.
He's a marketer first, second, and third. He wants his name on everything. And of course, 6 months later, he was going down the escalator to the music of Keep on Rocking in the Free World. Neil Young sued him and won. And he was running for president. That's what he is. He's a marketer.
Well, I'm just going to summarize right now. So there's lots of things to unfold yet before we know the extent of whether of Trump's threatened punishments for Canadian imports to the United States. The governors are going to play a really important role in how far he can push this agenda. And overall, taking all things into consideration, we're going to be okay.
There's going to be people, regrettably, that are going to lose their jobs in Canada in the short term. And it's going to be, we've got to figure out a way to bridge this. I know we went through this, you know, it's kind of interesting in a different context. I remember we did the groundbreaking exercise with Prime Minister Harper at the Canadian Museum for Human Rights. And it was in the middle of the financial crisis. And he got a call just after we shoveled the dirt to go right back to Ottawa or to Toronto because Bush had just announced huge financial contributions to the auto industry in the United States. So he had to go back immediately and match it. Otherwise we would have lost the whole auto industry in Canada. And so there are people that are going to be at risk, and we will have to figure out a way to bridge some of those industries. Mm-hmm. I know, Premier Canoes talked about maybe it's taxes. Maybe other people are talking about other things. One of the wins, by the way, he's gonna take credit for us changing the Canadian government with Trudeau, even though he had nothing to do with it. He probably, you know, gave Trudeau a little more profile after the messy financial statement was canceled with him switching finance ministers.
Well, maybe that could be his bumper sticker. You know, like I put a toe tag on Justin. You know,
he will the happiest person. He will take credit for it.
Gary, it's always good to catch up with you. You're very much the voice of reason in these crazy times. So we certainly appreciate your insights. And with a little bit of luck, we'd like to check in with you sooner rather than later, just so you can tell us again that, you know, we're going to be okay. For the most part, we're going to be okay.
We're Canadians. You know, we just got to keep making decisions and be decisive and be thoughtful. And we're a great country, the greatest country in the world, in my view, and we'll prove it again.
Yep. Paddle side down, navigate the rapids, yes?
Yeah, maybe I should use cross-country ski.
We'd like to really thank Gary for making time in his quote-unquote retirement. He remains an incredibly busy person, but always making time for us is one of the reasons
and
why.
And got up very early for us. Very early.
Yeah, you and I got up very early for it, Central Time Zone. Yeah,
blurry-eyed and all, but we were ready to talk. So
yeah, I think the salient points here are that Canada really does have cards to play on all this. Like we do have a response. One of the best things to come out of this is that we now know how to manage, irrational threats of tariffs and other, unfair trade practices. We've had experience before. We've always usually walked it back at the last moment. But now, you know what? We're in a state of readiness, of tariff war readiness. And that's not a bad thing. I think as well, too, we're all going to hope that the president's attention is drawn by another squirrel, that, you know, that something comes along.
Certainly, we see as the week rolls on, the American president's new interest in other areas of the world, creating forest fires elsewhere in the world, which may, in fact, harm us equally or worse or whatever. But the truth is that this particular crisis seems to be, as you very eloquently put it out, a lot of just game playing. And and it might be well served to remember that, you know, fool me once, fool me twice. And when he comes around again to make these threats, we might want to think about our response. We also might want to think a little bit about whether the carry through, or maybe we needed the extreme carry through to be able to roll things back. But one thing that I think you can't roll back, and maybe it might be more indicative, there is the Four Nations Cup coming up, hockey, in just a few days. In Montreal on the day after Valentine's Day, I can just imagine what that crowd's going to be like. You know, 18,000-20,000. I don't remember how many seats there are in the Montreal, was the Bell Center?
Yeah, 20,000. Yeah.
20,000 people, United States versus Canada in hockey.
Yeah, no, that's, And my personal plan is anybody who comes into, the Bell Center in Montreal wearing a Team USA jersey has to pay an immediate 25% tariff on their ticket. So
the uniting of people just can't be turned back. I'm very encouraged by that. I'm also, I'm at times just worried at times that when we become so nationalistic that we kind of forget certain commitments that we've made or certain things that we've thought about or certain things that we've made, made promises of to be better than in the past. But at the same time, I think the feeling is right now that everyone's on board and we have maybe a collective enemy to put our energy on. And whenever that's the case, Canadians tend to do better. Or they tend to act a little bit more focused anyways on building local economies, thinking about their neighbor, sharing more.
In a future podcast, I will look forward to talking about how all of this is going to disrupt the national political debate in this country. We're going to have an election, probably spring. I think it's already, changing the tilt of the field a little bit, but that is for a future podcast. There's nothing more that we can accomplish today.
Did we ever accomplish anything before? I'm not sure.
Well, we didn't get completely overrun by events as they evolved. We had to do is come back and record the opening segment of the podcast four times. So, you know,
We did do, but I hope everybody enjoyed it. I hope everyone enjoyed the song. Let's do more intros with Dan singing or not.
Or yeah, I was going to say, let's not encourage Dan.
Thanks everybody for tuning in. Also, big thanks to everyone at the Free Press, editor Paul Simin, our digital co-teammate Wendy Sawatsky, all the great people who make the Free Press possible. And just to let everybody know that Dan and I both have newsletters. And you both, it's free to subscribe. I bring out all the Indigenous stories that you're interested in, or that I do a top five segment of Indigenous stories across Turtle Island. Go to the Free Press website. Dan, you do Not for Attribution, talk about Manitoba politics, but also Canadian politics and everything else you're interested in.
Yeah, like in my first year doing it, I was really obsessed with public policy and primates. I'll have to explain that in a later, but you know, how the intersection of unbridled primate populations and public and government policy. But yeah, it's the newsletters are where we try to be informative, but also have a bit of fun. So I hope you'll subscribe and also please continue to listen to the podcast. Tell your friends to listen to the podcast. Don't abandon us now. We need you now.
I can't think of a better way. Thanks, everybody.